I'm Jeffrey Church from the Department of Political Science at the University of Houston. This is the Political Theory Review, a podcast of conversations with authors of recent books in political theory and social and political philosophy. Today, I'm talking to Richard Velkley, Celia Scott Weatherhead Professor of Philosophy at Tulane University. We're discussing his recent book, a philosophical novella entitled Sarastro's Cave, Letters from the Recent Past, from Mercer University Press. Velkley's research is on the history of philosophy, with particular interest in late modern continental philosophy from Rousseau and Kant onward, and he has written many books and articles on this period. Okay, well, first of all, Richard Velkley, welcome to the Political Theory Review.
Oh, thank you very much. It's a real pleasure to be here.
Richard, I loved reading this book. It's wonderful to read a novella, a philosophical novella. And I'm very eager to talk to you about, the features of this book. Let me first of all ask you to say a little bit about what motivated you to write this book in the first place.
All right. That is a rather long story, but I'll try to make it simple as possible. I've always had an interest in philosophic works that have what you could call a literary character or poetic character, as well as, you know, works of literature that have philosophic interest. Now, I mean, we have many examples of both of these things. I mean, philosophy with a literary side is, of course, in Plato, Descartes, Rousseau, Kierkegaard, Nietzsche, others one could mention. And then, you know, great works of literature that have philosophic intentions, Dante, Shakespeare, Swift, Voltaire, Dostoevsky, and others. All right. Well, I never thought that I'd write something as impressive as these works, but it did occur to me that it might be nice to try on a small scale something that's as philosophic character, well, being literary in form. But I didn't actually get pushed toward doing this until certain experiences. The experiences began back in 2012. After I published the book that studies Heidegger and Strauss together, I had several invitations to speak in this country and abroad. And I've spoken four European countries and in Brazil. And in the United States, touring about and going from place to place, and was enjoyable. At the same time, I found it to be a kind of disjointed experience, and the disjointed quality of spending time in airports and these tubes that fly through the air all seemed a bit strange, really. Many are used to a much more heavy schedule of this than I am. Other experiences related to the idea that our traditional political and social order is under great stresses, strains. And I happen to have around this time also a couple of health crises that broke up my routines significantly for a while. The country was going into a period of greater political polarization and a sense of having some common set of beliefs that unite the country was deteriorating. And all of this brought to mind the idea of a character, an imaginary character who is experiencing a problem with a view of the world he held, one that I wouldn't identify with myself, but with which I have some sympathy, and a kind of enlightenment view that sees politics and science and philosophy moving in tandem together in some progressive way, in some unified way. And this, the main character in the story, would experience as collapsing. That is the basic idea, which I used as a kind of hook for the story, was that the character has an operation, a major one, and waking up from it, he is unsure whether he's a living human being. And, he investigates why he thinks he may not be a living human being and how he might overcome that uneasy experience and recover a strong sense of being human. And you see the various factors in the world, not just his physical condition, but the factors in political life, social life, politics, contributed to this disorientation. So it occurred to me that it would be good to write about such a character and his efforts to recover. It also then occurred to me that an epistolary form for this would be appropriate. Because an epistolary form allows one to develop a character and a character's thoughts together, because the character's actions can be reflected on by the character and within the letters. And thus, this form lends itself to philosophic discussion, perhaps more than a straightforward novel narrative. And in other words, the use of letters can be treated as something like a dialogue. And when I got further into composing this, I was found myself appealing to four different genres, besides the epistolary romance, with which I give some Gothic features, to which I give some Gothic features because literary literature in the early 19th century is often rather Gothic. And it combined with a more recent popular genre, the academic novel, another recent one, the science fiction dystopia. These elements were put within a framework of classical allegory as well. And so, of course, the title, Zarathustra's Cave, brings forward the cave motif. That makes one think of Plato, but also the motif of the underworld, which is so important in classical literature. Visits to the underworld, Odysseus and Aeneas, and the mythological underworld of Orpheus. So these four elements went into the writing, and then the themes besides the recovery from this illness are, let's say, the major themes are the importance of letter writing itself as a theme, the role of music in the life of the main character, as well as the role of friendship and, in some complex relation with that, a certain romantic or erotic relationship. So I guess I could just briefly say that the story is about a history professor who lives and works somewhere on a Louisiana campus, but not in New Orleans. He doesn't live there. And I see he does like to visit at times. He teaches early modern European history with a particular focus upon Freemasonry, on the history of the movement and on its principles and thought. And I'd mentioned a story about his experience of a very strange and completely disruptive change in his life and his the questions he asks about it, which give him a motive for writing letters, where he thinks of letter writing as a way to recover a sense of human relationships, a sense of being human. He writes to several correspondents, Each of these correspondents seems to be a good friend and a person in some different area of life from his own work. Although there are affinities. One person is a composer, another is a political scientist, another is a poet, another is a mathematician, and another is a freelance translator who lives in London. And then there is a student, a more mature and advanced student who is, well, let's say they have a mutual friendship and share a lot of. That story gets rather complicated. In the course of time, he in this correspondence, he overcomes his doubts about whether he's human, but that's not the end of the story. That's not the end of the complexity. He has, he may, let's say, a new sense of being human, and yet it's not exactly the kind of humanity he was looking for. So, he encountered still, some serious crisis. That's really just speaking about it in a very general way. But add, you see, that his uncertainty about being human may seem like an exaggerated trope, but I relate it directly to things we have in the world around us. I mean, our fascination with electronic devices, with computers, with artificial intelligence, together with, let's say, the declining influence of the humanities and the liberal arts, which are constantly being cut back in colleges and universities in favor of professional, vocational majors, the breakdown of political discussion into non-communicating factions. All of this seems to be destroying the basis for really human discourse. And so it's to me not so far-fetched that a human being might have some strange crisis after which he may wonder whether he is perhaps a form of artificial intelligence or a robot. And of course, at the same time, he has doubts about this. So he pursues questions and re inquiries to help him formulate what is really human. Now, that's just a brief account of what this is about, how I got into it. Maybe it was a little too long.
No, that was useful. I was going to pick up there just on the I think the point, the theme of crisis that you bring up in the book. It seemed to me that Clovis, the main character, is insofar as the Magic Flute is his favorite opera, classical Enlightenment opera, and he's a devotee of the Freemasons, at least at the beginning. So kind of representative of high enlightenment in the way you described a minute ago, and that he undergoes a kind of crisis, reflecting the kind of crisis of the Enlightenment that thinkers from the 19th century up to the present have kind of
Yes.
identified. And I was wondering maybe if you could say a little bit about the nature of that crisis in his life, and then more generally in the the sort of philosophical resonance of it. It seemed to me that there were two different themes that you were developing there. One is the, I think, as you were speaking at about a minute ago, the mechanization of human life that's brought about through a kind of enlightenment conception of the world that seeks to mathematize and mechanize the world to make it manipulable. But the other one, the other theme that I got a sense that comes up in a few of the letters was, I guess you could say, the fragmentation of modern enlightenment life. This comes up at a couple places where you talk about the kind of political crises and the decline of discourse. That there's one letter in which you talk about how there's nothing left to critique anymore, or Clovis says, there's nothing left to critique anymore because no one is kind of talking to one another. Everyone is talking past one another. There's no everything changes at every moment. It's like a, you know, river you can't step in the same time twice, et cetera. So I got a sense that there were kind of those two different themes of crisis that kind of intertwine themselves into Clovis's life and more generally. Does that capture it? Do you have other things to add? Yeah.
Yes. Well, that's well said. Well, his starting point is, as you say, a great attachment to enlightenment as in his conception, a unified vision of the world. I mean, enlightenment when it is fully sensing and living for him is something that is a unified vision of, and its account of politics and science and human passions and aspirations, and certain conception of humanity that is to be realized by it. And certain works of art, especially, express this, such as the Magic Flute of Mozart, or let's say some of the music of Beethoven, and some of the major authors of the Enlightenment era. But he begins to see that the scientific and technological aspect of this vision is having some disturbing consequences, and undermining a sense of the human. And so this is, let's say, a key element of what you're calling the fragmentation experience. So the scientific aspect doesn't seem to be cohering with the moral and humanitarian. They seem to be kind of increasingly growing at odds with each other. And the fragmentation then becomes the dominant experience he has, a sense of this unified vision as collapsing. And one can say that he continues to search for another way to experience a unifying whole. You might say something like a closed vision of the world, a kind of closed doctrine, one might to salvage this or to replace it. Something better, something needed, which gets connected with his theme of leading a musical existence. So his preoccupation with music is really quite strong in the second half of the novella. It does divide rather well into halves. The emphasis on music begins to be underlined in letter 17 out of, there are 33 letters in all. And number 16 is, just before that, is his most articulate defense of choosing the epistolary form, the letter form, for writing. So he finds that as an artistic ploy helpful to him. But then you see, shifting quite quickly, he takes up music. And music may, in fact, be the profounder pull upon him. Music has this advantage, as emerges in one of his letters, of being the most abstract of the arts, so that it perhaps is especially well suited to conveying an idea of the unity of experience or the unity of the world, which is, actually a line of thought pursued in several writers of the past 200 years. And maybe it reaches a high point in the 19th century with Schopenhauer and Wagner and Nietzsche, and he's drawn to something of this kind. But as those examples, especially the Wagner example, and of course his love of Mozart, indicate, music also has a kind of flexibility in that it can be combined with a text and with a spectacle, that it can be blended with the verbal and the visual. So opera acquires a particular, important for him. In letter 17, he has a recollection of a very early exposure to opera and how he realizes that this has been something like an underlying thread in his life. Opera is also an image of a kind of complexity of different genres, different ways of thinking brought together into one work. So it is something of a mirror to the role of letter writing in his life, because as a letter writer, he's also, reaching out to human beings engaged with by different activities and thinking about himself in relationship to different activities. I don't know if that was helpful to care.
Yeah. I was wondering if I could read. I was going to read letter 16, which is about the,
you
just mentioned a minute ago. It's Clovis's statement about the importance of letter writing and kind of what it means for him. And I was wondering, maybe I could just read it, and then we can talk a little bit about the epistolary form. Yeah. And what it means. So letter 16 is dated January 14th, 2016. So much of the action of this novella takes place 2016 and then 2017.
Mm-hmm.
It's addressed to Dear Esmond. I want to share with you a few musings I've had since my announcement, no doubt startling to you, of my descent into Hades. I've had some glimmerings of how I might ascend from my cave. Just a few months ago, I was writing to another friend, Abel Mapp, and in the course of writing, it struck me that I was then engaged in an activity that no mechanized being could undertake or successfully imitate. Why was I writing a letter? In seeking this resonance in another person, I was attempting to discover myself in the imagined perspective of another. Such a quest is a sign of our incompleteness, animated by a hope, perhaps a vain hope, to become less incomplete through the exchange. I was then hit by the thought that the exchange is less important than the creation of the absent addressee, whose fictional existence enables one to pose questions and to imagine one's situation as seen by a second eye. I hatched the plan to write an epistolary novel, and I conveyed this sudden inspiration, perhaps a will-o'-the-wisp, to my friend Allegra Cantaro. I think she is more concerned about my mental health than impressed by my scheme. Her poetic sense is more grounded in the earth than my typically abstract speculations and enthusiasms. In any case, I was at first attracted to producing a novel built around a fictional character with fictional correspondence, but then fell back to a plan of using my own correspondence as the core of the book. Is this a lapse, or is it a sort of pedestrian realism asserting itself in an unhealthy way? But the two approaches are hardly different, since my autobiographical novel would also be fictional, in which the identities of my friends would be masked in a variety of ways, and my editorial hand would revise and refine a great deal. In the finished work, the friends would become impalpable ghosts who summon me towards acts of reflection, self-reckoning, and a final judgment, and perhaps even to revenge for our age's murder of something great, a vision of human excellence that I am losing. Now look, I am crying on the battlements of Elsinore. I am haunted by a feeling that my work may never be completed. As I said, letter writing is inherently a dialogue with absence, and no author can have the final word without that interlocutor. Yet in every letter, there must be a last word, and so let it be here. Yours ever, Clovis. Yeah, so it's wonderful stuff here. I was wondering maybe, if you could expand a little bit on the epistolary form and why you chose it. I think it's sort of very interesting to think through exactly the philosophical significance of letter writing as Clovis is outlining here, that it's a kind of conjuring of another I. I think, you know, in the way in which that other I summons, I'm not sure if you had Fichte in mind, but there's a kind of way in which there's a kind of Fichtean summoning and a recognition that involves a kind of inner subjective character of approaching an I, but it's one that's always absent. So it's one that's always in the process of approaching some kind of wholeness, but never actually achieve it. We never, for example,
yes.
We never hear the other sides of the letters in your novel, right? It's only
yeah.
just Clovis. So there's always an incompleteness mm-hmm. there.
Yes, that's right. Well, that was really well said. Clovis is suggesting, I would say, that imagining of another I in your letter writing, you know, although it is another person, it's in some way an I like yourself, is both same and different to oneself, is actually present in all writing and perhaps in all speaking. It's just more manifest, more explicit, at least something that is happening in a writing of a letter. Of course, you can say something similar about a written dialogue. And theme that you're speaking about so well arises in a related way when Clovis has reflections on imagination and speaks of the imaginative faculty of humans as both remarkable and troubling, in that we live much of our lives with with various anticipations of what we will do and what we will be at various future points, so that we're always conjuring up something like future selves of ourselves. Now, you know, much of the time these are not realized in life in actuality. They nevertheless have extremely powerful influence upon how we live. And the sense that we are exposed always to a future which we don't know, and yet we try to shape, and in which we imagine ourselves as somehow already present, you know, as you picture yourself going about activity, like traveling somewhere, or meeting people, or writing something. And because we hoist ourselves into these futural forms, we also imagine how in these forms we are subject to many forces. We are subject to questions from others, challenges from the world. We could be both praised and welcomed, or we could be shunned and attacked. And this ability to project ourselves into the future is certainly a condition for having a conspiratorial thinking. Says quite a bit about how we are drawn into thinking of the force of conspiratorial actions and thought. And says imagination is a bit of a curse, actually. And he draws upon statements in Hobbes and Samuel Johnson to help articulate them, you know, so that they both have this reflections and working on this aspect of human imagination. Johnson writes, none are happy but by anticipation of change. And, thus we live not entirely in the present, nor only in the present and past, but in this drawn into this draft that comes from an imagined future. That's connected, although I maybe haven't made it clear, to the theme of letter writing and why letter writing is significant form for Clovis, precisely because of what you mentioned, division within oneself, you know, and that, you know, this exchange with an imagined other is a certain way that we address our own incompleteness. You know, we sense that we need to draw closer, akin to ourselves, that will make us seem less incomplete. And he says this is not a way of thinking or a concern that a machine could ever have. This is inherently a human, you know, it's a human concern to address others, listen to others, you know, to do things like write letters, or, you know, create works of art or works of literature. And you see how these themes are interrelated, letter writing, the imagination, the deficiency of machine intelligence, or its lack of human character. Well, I'll stop there. I'm glad you read that letter because it is a very good one to bring forward.
Yeah, and I was thinking you've written so much about Rousseau and Rousseau's influence on the critique of the Enlightenment and the responses to the Enlightenment and German philosophy.
Right.
And I'm just thinking about Rousseau in this context, the idea and his very pivotal idea of amour propre, and how what's distinctively human beings is that we understand ourselves through the eyes of others, which is not something that machines do. So Clovis can sort of liberate himself through this sort of our imaginative capacity. But as we know with Rousseau, amour propre can be easily inflamed and can kind of get us out of control. So there develops, you know, in the wake of Rousseau, a series of efforts in order to kind of respond to the problem of the perpetual incompleteness of the human soul. There's one point in the editor, and I should say the novella is framed in an intriguing way by one Richard Velkley, which I will not identify with you, but maybe we could identify with you. In any case, one Richard Velkley who comes upon these letters, but in the conclusion, this Richard Velkley summarizes the development of Clovis as a kind of development from Enlightenment to Romanticism to phenomenology to existentialism. And I was wondering maybe you could comment on that and Clovis's kind of philosophical development. We've been talking a lot about the sort of artistic side of things, but the sort of philosophical development and what's maybe... It seems like there's a kind of inadequacy there for Clovis in terms of the philosophical responses to this problem of incompleteness.
Good, yes. In that final, well, in an epilogue where I'm discussing what I found in the letters after I've read them with and the park ranger who originally gave them to me, I do recapitulate these stages of his thought. And I'm actually referring to some things he says in the final letter in the collection, the one where he's addressing all of his friends at once and says that, you know, he's come to a kind of impasse because he has been seeking to find a musical way of existing. And, which has failed, and he mentioned, you know, something like a history of thought, very brief one, in which music is playing a large role, I mean, he starts with the fact that there's something important about music already recognized in the early modern Enlightenment. He refers to Leibniz's notion of harmony. And then he says the focus on music becomes very explicit in Rousseau and is developed in a number of Romantic writers and reaches perhaps a kind of high point in Schopenhauer's association of music with the spirit of the world or the unconscious forces behind the world, followed by Nietzsche's account of the Dionysian. And then he said, but at that point, it becomes doubtful whether music will allow communicative lucidity, that is, Apollonian. And it says, well, I won't try to pursue any more musico-philosophic history. But see, what he has realized is that that unifying role of music is not working. I mean, it's not working within the world around him, but he has doubts about whether it can work at all in more favorable circumstances. And that's where the discussion of the Fellini movie, 8 and a Half, is relevant. For he has an interpretation of that film as an effort on the part of the frustrated director, movie director, Guido, the effort on his part, as Clovis sees it, is to produce a musical reflection of his own life or his own existence. 8 and a Half he sees as a as an operatic work, which I think it is. I think, in fact, it's an important work. It brings together music and action and character in an operatic way. And and it's actually a very serious film. It's not just about, you know, a kind of ne'er-do-well character who's rather narcissistic. He has, you know, an understandable aspiration, which at bottom is rather profound, but his own project failed, and Clovis believes that that had to happen, that unifying work of art could not be made, and because life with its contingency intrude and undermine the effort to have this closure and completeness through a pure work of art. So Guido speaks in terms of a few times in the film of attaining innocence, and innocence is akin to the idea of musical work bringing about kind of untroubled unity, our world, our life. Now, those are doubts then that, yes, that Clovis has arrived at through some thinking through of certain episodes philosophically in the philosophy of the past few centuries. I mean, he doesn't develop everything in a systematic and explicit way. It's more through various references that one sees how he has thought about these things. As you mentioned, he does make a turn late in the letters toward phenomenology and existentialism, in particular Heidegger, and finds that Heidegger's account of being in the world is particularly illuminating as an account of how humans exist in a radically different way from anything mechanistic, algorithmic. Even as he is impressed by this, though, he's disappointed, because he says, you find very little moral psychology in it, and you know, too little reflection upon, you know, the human as a complex being, seeing everything in the light of the overwhelming theme of being. And right, so let us go back to the point that in the last letter, he's reached a kind of impasse. And the truth of the matter is he still is looking for a kind of closed doctrine. That's what's preventing him from being really philosophic and why he remains in a cave, in a sense, metaphorically. Although his previous conceptions of it have failed him. So, you know, the ending of the novel, the ending of the story is to say that he is lost in the cave. He falls into the cave irretrievably. And one has to think that in a philosophical sense, it means he couldn't get over this effort to have what I'm calling a closed doctrine or a unified, perfectly unified and whole view of things, which is, you know, preventing one from seeing the world clearly and coping with its complexity, which philosophy really requires it. So, am I making sense?
Yes. Yeah. It made me think that, I mean, and here's in an interpretation. I mean, since you're the author, I can run this past you. Tell me whether it's right. It strikes me that, you know, this is a novel about kind of the limitations of Clovis does, and yeah, spoiler alerts, you know, dies at the end of the novel, falling into an abyss in the cave. And
that's revealed on the back of the book too.
Oh, okay, all right. So there you go. Right. So, so there's a. It strikes me that you know, this is a critique of a kind of way of doing philosophy and thinking about beauty. That's a little bit like Hegel's critique of the beautiful soul. That is, that it's all about self and not about world. That is, like it's a, you know, it's a turning inward and an attempt to kind of address the fractures of the world by beautifying and perfecting oneself,
yes.
Which is reflected in the epistolary form, right? Because you never hear anybody else in this novel. You just hear
right
Clovis's own mind and his own reflections about that. I mean, I want to talk about the erotic point in a second, but that also leads me, his relationship with Myrna also makes me think. But it, I mean, is that close?
Yes.
Interpretation. Go ahead. Yeah.
Yes. Well, he mentions Hegel, and I think that reference to Hegel's criticism is quite appropriate. He is clearly interested in the Hegelian account of, you know, a critique of positions like the beautiful soul. But then he kind of dismisses Hegel rather abruptly when he says that Hegel rounds off everything with the mutual recognition of subject, so that he's like an old spinster who's busy with some knitting, which he doesn't really love, or she doesn't really love, but cannot put aside. So he doesn't find the Hegelian conception of mutual recognition of subjects as sufficiently elevating, sufficiently, you might say, not sufficiently erotic, really, you might say. And yeah, so there is a way in which he's still seeking something that is more like the unified romantic conception, even as he's discovering that it's challenged in many ways. And that relates to the experience with the young woman, directly related problem of his pursuit of this unity or this completeness, because you know, the Where remember, he's reflecting often about how troublesome imagination is, how that's stumbling block. And in relationship to her, his imagination, it goes in kind of onto uncontrolled tangents. And, you know, without even close contact, he just is imagining that she's getting too involved with this other friend named Vance. And you know, he's developing a kind of envy of their friendship. And you might bring in the Rousseauian point again, that our imagination and our passions come under the sway so much of what others wish and others think and what others do, which it deprives us of the ability to, you know, live peacefully and thoughtfully in the present. And, you know, whipping up our passions as we imagine things, often, you know, quite unreal things that other human beings are doing. And, you know, so he can't put aside feelings of a romantic or erotic sort, but at the same time, they are wreaking havoc with his mental life. I think that this is related. I mean, I know it's been rather complicated detour, but it is related to what you were observing about the Hegelian critique of, you know, romantic philosophy. The book does produce, I think, a lot of complexity, because just on the basis of some rather limited comments on various things, one has to think how they together form a coherent picture. And you see, so Clovis, again, Clovis sees that there is an appropriate critique of what he is seeking, but cannot free himself. And there has to be for him something, a unified vision of things, which will include a place for Eros, but at the same time he is drawn into conflicts and whipsawed about by, you know, erotic feeling. And is that helpful at all?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, maybe you could say a little bit about letter 26, which is he's writing to Myrna, and this is the letter in which he reveals that Myrna kind of directs him to Edgar Allan Poe's story, the Telltale Heart.
Yes.
And he's completely disturbed. Like, why would you compare me to the narrator of the Telltale Heart? He's a murderer, you know. And it reveals the, you know, there's this beating heart under the floorboards. And so
yes.
what is this?
Yeah.
So maybe you could expand on that moment. I mean, what is the you know, Clovis seems completely taken aback. What's the background what's the significance of this?
Well, that just shows how he is predisposed to be rather beside himself. I mean, here she has said something just rather amusing about this story. Well, you know, she is on to something about him. She is aware, you know, that he will that he can be misled by his own imaginings, since he is, you know, indicating to her that he's got concerns about her relationship with Vance, things about this to Vance as well. And so she's mocking him a bit for you know, and manipulating him with making the parallel. For, you know, she knows that he probably is feeling somewhat guilty about his envious inquiry. So she plays on that, and she tells the story, retells, or at least redirects him to the story of the Telltale Heart, where the murderer is overcome with a sense of a fear and guilt when the police come into his home, and he has put the murdered victim beneath the floorboard of the house. And here he himself, the murderer, hears the beating heart beneath the floorboard. At last can't contain himself, but says that he had shocked out. Here it is, here's what you are looking for. So she exploits her overheated imagination, and he falls right into it, right into the trap. And even as he's telling the story, he says, "I did this, I did that," as assuming this role of the character, assuming the role of the murderer. It is revealing something about his thinking, and I meant it also to be a rather playful episode. And I try to alleviate some rather heavy and dark themes with playful elements. And that just leads me to another point, which I ought to stress, that I wanted to write something which isn't at all didactic or, clearly arguing for, a answer or doctrine of some kind. I just wanted to portray some problems that I believe we've had. And, to do that with fictional characters seems to me to be an especially good way to, without a doctrinal intent, to display, some problems that humans face.
Yeah, that seems good. I mean, I wanted to ask you on this point, maybe, and I think it's probably an artificial distinction to make, but I'll ask the question in this way. I mean, it does seem to me that yes, the novella is about, philosophy and art in a crisis in the 21st century. But so I guess here's the question: Is, I think, at the heart of it, the crisis due to the nature and development of philosophy, or is it due to the nature and development of politics and culture? I'm sure the answer is going to be. I'm sure the answer is going to be both, which is why I said, it's an artificial distinction. But is this when you're writing this? I mean, is this are you thinking more about the development of art and philosophy into the modern era? Are you thinking more about broader developments in, say, Western culture that are sort of undermining the efforts of philosophy and art
Okay, this is you raise really a very important one, and it requires more explicit and careful consideration. I mean, I'm presenting elements of a picture which are suggesting how to produce connecting links. And now what I would say is that what is happening, and it's not something really Clovis has clearly understood, is that philosophy has taken on a special role in the modern centuries of producing a kind of practical, unifying vision of the world to modify everything, political institutions, the practice of science, the education of human beings, the approach to actions, all of it being directed by certain philosophic purposes, in a far more fundamental and engaged way than you find in, I think at least it can be argued, in pre-modern forms of philosophy, which pre-modern forms of philosophy are simply more dedicated to, you know, the life of inquiring and learning, which is necessarily primarily a preoccupation of a rather small number of human beings, or at least not every human being. And modern philosophy is attempting to provide kind of unifying conceptions of life to transform all of life. And you know, the so I mean, in the belief that all of that can be over time progressively achieved, so that one approaches some kind of culminating achievement, some completion of history. And Clovis is, without fully understanding it, experiencing the dissolution of that idea. But at the same time, he is looking for a another form of it. He's hoping to find another answer akin to it, and doesn't emerge from that cave, you know, that cave of a modern Enlightenment kind of cave, a kind of cave that philosophy itself has created. Is that making sense?
Yeah, it reminds me, I mean, you've done work on Leo Strauss, and it made me think that, you know, maybe this book was a Straussian book in the sense that it follows Strauss's, you know, broader critiques of modernity, in which modern thought creates a cave beneath the cave in his famous image, right? And so, of course, Clovis falls into the abyss. That, you know, the cave isn't just like in Plato's Republic, right, where there's just people sitting there. It's actually, you know, bottomless, right? So modernity creates a kind of bottomless cave that you fall ever more further away from the truth.
There's and, truth, you know, in what you're, yes.
Okay. Go ahead. I mean, there is a point that Clovis does, I think, dismiss kind of Straussian thought in one of the letters. And that made me think maybe this is a clue, you know, maybe a path not taken, to read a little bit more closely Strauss's critique of the things, and then turn back to the classics.
Yes, well, I mean, you're right in that this was very much on my mind, but at the same time, I wanted the reader to have a sense in reading this of some sympathy for what Clovis is thinking and trying to achieve. And I didn't want to present it purely in a critical or negative light, which I think happens rather often in circles. So, you know, I wanted to show the attraction and the humanity of the concerns of Clovis. And, you know, to show why it is humanly appealing. And also, yes, I mean, he does make some critical remarks that relate to this professor in Chicago, Etienne, and his followers. It's not clear that he knows a great deal, and he seems to have a rather simplified view of things. But he does want to make a distinction between what he knows about the professor's own thought, which he says is concerned with questioning and, you know, subtle interpretations of text. He makes a distinction between that and an attitude that Clovis has found in a number of the followers of the Chicago professor, which is the belief that through reading Plato and Xenophon, they have attained a kind of transhuman standpoint and somehow see so clearly what others don't see, the emptiness of human hopes and human aspirations. And he suspects that there's something spurious about that. For these people are just as likely to have human foibles and non-philosophic passions as others, as their squabbles and quarrels with each other, you know, reveal. So, I mean, he has some grasp of what is happening there, but so I want to say there may be a kind of distortion of what Leo Strauss is undertaking that would deserve some criticism from a Clovis character. And at the same time wanted to show that his concerns have some human interest. I mean, perhaps if he could approach some of his Enlightenment ideas with somewhat more flexibility or somewhat more ability to accept the insolubility and open-endedness of human life. If he could do that, maybe there would be a place for some Enlightenment ideas that is still at least has some possibility of helping us through practical problems, you know. And so I wanted to present a view that wasn't one-sidedly critical of him, even as I do relate, as you say, the events of this book, the actions that take place in it, some ideas about philosophy in the modern period that I have, in some good measure, learned through the work of Strauss and some of his students. So my answer is yes, but with its qualifying.
Good, yeah. Last question. It has to do with kind of, I guess, the overall project of the book. This is it. And on the very first page of the book, you say that the present work attempts to fulfill the designs of another author, which is a perilous undertaking. So I guess the simple question is, what do you take? So this is your editor's preface. This is, or I shouldn't say you, because this is the character Richard Velkley undertaking the present work to fulfill the designs of another author named Clovis Mendeling. I mean, the simple question is, what do you take to be the designs of Clovis in this? And I think just related to that is, I think what you say a little bit later in this first section of the editor's preface, which is that you compare your activity as an editor of this epistolary novel to the activity of interpretation of classical texts, and say in a way that it's kind of a relief to actually just assemble these letters rather than actually have the foolhardy effort of trying to reconstruct the thought of past philosophers. I was wondering if you could just sort of conclude by also talking about how you take your activity of writing a novella to be related to your activity of interpretive scholarship and philosophy that you've been engaged in your career.
Oh, that's a hard question, and you're asking me to deal with this in the remaining 3 minutes or.
Take the time you want. Yeah.
Yes. Well, the opening line, the opening sentence that you read, important for this topic. Now when the editor says he's attempting to fulfill the design of Clovis as author, he means that he's taking on a responsibility that is given to him by the owners of the letters, the original owners, who are asking him, you know, to bring these letters into some kind of public form and do it in a way that would fit the intentions of Clovis,
right?
And I compare that to the task when he has as an interpreter of, you know, texts of other authors, where you say your chief intent is to convey the understanding of this author accurately. You know, understand that author. We use that expression as he understood the author. And and when we're assuming that role, right, we're claiming just to bring forward that person's thought without making the judgment whether it is true or false. You know, we're not, if I'm interpreting something by Rousseau, I'm not making the effort to teach Rousseau as the truth, or, you know, the true in philosophy. So there's a parallel between this editor's task and that of scholarly interpreter. And it should be recognized how precarious that is. You know, how it's not in any way a straightforward kind of task. You know, I mean, we deal with, as editor here says, with just small hints as to what the ultimate intent is. Of course, Clovis has actually left only small hints as to what he intended to do. Clovis said in a note, which he attached to the letters, "I hope to use these letters to make a book, which they would retain their character as individual utterances, although they would become parts of a larger whole." And I, as editor here, you know, am faced with having to take the individual letters and think of them both as having integrity as individual utterances, yet as parts of a larger whole. So how am I to think about these letters in both respects? And that's really quite similar to the task one takes of interpreting any complicated and significant text. How is one to think of it as a whole? What's understanding the parts accurately? Is one doing something that goes beyond the text in some way? Is there actually a way in which you're completing the writing? I mean, I find that there are various possibilities for dealing with the text, and that it might be the intent expressed in that sentence might be achieved by transforming the letters into something else, like dialogues or chapters of a continuous narration, in which they would still have their independent aspects, but still be parts of the whole. And I decided I couldn't come up with a form of that sort. I didn't find any basis for thinking that would be a solution. So I simply chose to present the letters as I found them. And I say that, well, in a way, I'm just completing these letters, then, these writings, by doing as little as possible and to present them as a collection. And I say, well, I find this to be a somewhat easier task than what I have undertaken with writing books and articles on the books and articles of other authors. Now, in other words, I am just leaving these letters as I found them, and then the mystery of their production remains a mystery for others. I'm not claiming to solve it. excuse me. So I don't know. I'm not really clarifying very well, I suppose, here. What's the great issue behind your question? But the task of scholarly interpretation may, in fact, lead us into some forms of transformation that we maybe don't wholly acknowledge to ourselves. And may, in fact, there may be legitimate reasons for taking it. I mean, to take a very lofty example, there is the case that Platonic version of Socrates is most probably quite different from historical Socrates, at least different in crucial ways, and that Plato has produced a new Socrates, Socrates which will have a certain life into the future that Plato intends to have, that may be different from anything Socrates had in mind, who, after all, chose never to write. So I'm just hinting at that problem of, of philosophical interpretation and presenting it as an aporia, which I don't really resolve. I mean, I don't resolve it in relation to letters. And at least as the editor, assuming the role of editor here, I just leave things, you might say, as an aporia. Of course, there's something not quite genuine about that because I've authored the entire work.
Right. I took this as ironic that there's a creativity that's involved in all acts of interpretation, just in the same way that ironically you said I've done nothing. Richard Bilkley has done nothing, but of course Richard Bilkley has done the creative activity of producing.
Yeah.
This thing.
Yeah.
So there's a creativity at the heart of our project, which I take it, this bends back to the motivation question that we started with, that it's, back to how Richard Bilkley, the interpreter, come to be Richard Bilkley, the novel writer. And I take it there's a kind of creativity that's involved in our form of philosophical interpretation. So
I think that's right. Even though I have some reservations about the term creativity or what the connotation tends to have. But for creativity tends to refer to an activity that has no inherent direction, to be something rather blind, when does one create simply out of nothing? And then if that's so, what kind of purpose or direction will it have? So I do have some reservation about speaking of creativity, and yet I see at the same time the validity of the point you're making. There's something into it that has a place in philosophic writing and in interpreting as well. Interpreting. I'll leave it at that.
Good. Yeah, well, Richard, again, I thoroughly enjoyed the novel and I thoroughly enjoyed this conversation. So thanks again for joining me on the Political Theory Review.
Thank you. It's really been enjoyable for me. And I hope it was helpful. So, and thank you very much for the opportunity.
You've been listening to the Political Theory Review. Find us on the web and on iTunes. Thanks to the Starting Points Journal for partnering with us. And thanks to you for listening.